Good, so welcome back. So, yes, in this half I want to start looking more closely at the Metta-sutta, particularly looking through the lens of Bhante's commentary on the Metta-sutta, which is published in this book, Living with Kindness. But before we do that, before I start talking about the Metta-sutta, I just wanted to see if there were any comments about the Metta Bhavana meditation that we've just done before the tea break, where I was encouraging you just to explore, not trying particularly to cultivate anything, and to see what happens, just as an experiment. Not that that's the whole of the practice, but as an exploration of what happens. So I'd just be interested in seeing if there are any comments, how you found that. Somebody was talking to me in the tea break. Yes.
Now that this is the final person that you that really like so much. I realised they weren't that bad.
Oh.
I was quite surprised by that.
Right. And that was without you trying to do anything.
I was like, actually.
Yeah. That's interesting, isn't it? Sometimes all it takes is us becoming a little bit more aware and allowing space around that awareness. And then somehow we have a truer kind of understanding. So that's really good. That's great. Yeah.
I kind of felt, I realised how much my emotions change and I don't have to attach myself to my emotions. But like in the second stage, I was thinking of my friend and I had these real positive feelings. I was in the feelings, like I was having those feelings, but I was also looking at myself as well I was having it and I was looking at myself as well at the same time. And the fourth stage, I realised how much I don't like this person, but it's okay.
Yeah.
And the neutral, I was just really, it was like bland.
Yeah.
I couldn't really focus on this person. It was just like, I don't feel anything for you whatsoever.
Yeah.
But I was still with that person.
Well, in a way, that what you've described is the natural, what you'd expect from those three stages. And what you say about having feelings, but also being aware of the fact that you're having feelings, is, I think, the crucial element that I'm trying to get at, is bringing awareness and a sort of non-judgmental awareness to whatever's going on. If we can do that, then we've got the foundation for the practice. Very often, we don't have that awareness. It's mindfulness, really. We don't have that mindfulness. And it's like we're having the feeling and we're lost in them. So we're not even aware that we're having the feeling. We're just lost in the story or the strength of the emotion. And we're not aware of what we're doing. So this exercise was just to start us becoming more aware, but in a friendly way that allows whatever is there to be there. It's only then that we can intelligently start to cultivate metta, if we need to. But what you notice, for example, with the friend, that there was already metta there. Yeah. And you don't need to then push. Yeah. Is anybody else cold in here? Some of you look a bit cold. Jim, could you turn that extract off? Thank you. And then we'll see if it gets stuffy, then we'll turn it back on. Maybe one more. Any last comments or thoughts? Oh, two more. Go on then. I'll take both of you. So Maggie first.
Okay. Just that felt much more natural.
Right.
And easy.
Yeah.
Than without the phrases and without trying to cultivate anything.
Yeah.
It felt to me like the person was there with me.
Ah.
And that's how I would normally be with that person.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm trying to cultivate something that I'm too so busy cultivating something that actually there's no need to get involved in it so much.
Yes. Yes. So I think that's exactly the point. That if you can, there is something very natural and easy. And if we can bring that sort of sense of ease and naturalness to the practice and allow ourselves to just be with the person and then notice what our responses are. On the basis of that, after we've given that some space and time, on the basis of that, we can start to then gently encourage a cultivation towards well-wishing, if we need to. It might be that just by being with that person, what naturally arises is a sense of goodwill and open-heartedness. And then, if that's the case, all you need to do is notice that that's happening. And if you notice that it's happening and take an interest in the experience, then it deepens of its own accord. And there isn't any need to then use phrases or any other sorts of encouragement. If, however, after a while, nothing is happening, or you're drifting, or there isn't enough interest, then you can bring in, but very, very gently and subtly, an element of cultivation. And it might be a phrase, or it might not be. I think sometimes we get too habituated to phrases. So it's important to not get locked into just one method. You might not want to use phrases at all. You might just want to use your imagination a little bit more, or direct your interest a little bit, or maybe use some sort of reflection if you want to. But only on the basis of really staying with that person in a natural way, and then doing it very sparingly and gently, the cultivation part, I mean, very sparingly, very gently, not rushing in with may you be well, may you be well, may you be well, and you haven't even taken the time to really take them in, be aware of them, or indeed aware of how it is for you in the presence of this person, if you see what I mean. Yeah. So much, much more subtle and slow, gentle. Yeah.
Then the second and the third stages were the most interesting for me.
Yeah.
In the second stage, well, towards the end of the first stage, I was actually feeling quite neutral towards myself, which
yeah.
I hadn't expected.
Yeah.
And then the instant the second stage began, I had almost an overwhelming sense of metta, which came out of nowhere, really.
Yeah.
But then as the second stage progressed, I realised that it, parts of my friendship were perhaps not so filled with metta.
Sure.
And then in the third stage, I had a neutral person, but nonetheless a person who I quite like.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a weak, almost a pathetic wishing well for this person, nothing too strong.
Sure.
And the reason I found it interesting was that the second stage reflected a much stronger kind of relationship where it's double-edged sword, really, where there's a lot of love, but then possibly a bit of jealousy or tension as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that it would be better if all my relationships were like the one I have with the person in the third stage, only a bit more forceful.
Strong.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a really important reflection. That's a really important reflection. Well, two things. One is I think you're right. I think you're right because metta tends towards a more and more unconditional well-wishing that isn't so bound up with what that person does or how they respond to us. So in that sense, you're right. It is a bit more like the third stage. But you're also right to say that metta can become strong even for people that we don't know, just like it can be strong for people that we really like. So it's an important reflection because it's true, but also what I find interesting is that that reflection arose naturally just by you staying with these people without trying to necessarily cultivate anything. And in a way, these sort of insights are available to us if we take an interest in our experience, it's if we take an interest in our experience, it's like our experience teaches us things. So that's very, very good. That's an example of that. Yeah. So what I'd suggest is that if that was useful for you, that you carry on trying to explore what I call the receptive dimension. Well, it's not just what I call it, is the receptive dimension of meditation. So in a way, what we were doing is the metta-bhavana with a strong bias towards just sitting. Yeah? Just sitting in a non-judgmental, kindly awareness. But then on the basis of that, you start to gently bring in the art of cultivation. But very slowly, subtly, gently. Almost like you're learning the practice for the first time. And don't feel obliged to use the phrases. And if you do use the phrases, or whatever you use, use it very sparingly, with lots of time to then sit back and then notice the response in a kindly, friendly kind of way. Okay, good. So, the Metta Sutta. So, it comes, as I say, from an early collection, one of the earliest Buddhist texts. Comes from a collection called the Sutta Nipata. And I think what that sort of first of all indicates is that the Metta Bhavana and practices like the Metta Bhavana were there right from the time of the Buddha. The Buddha was teaching these practices. It's not just later Buddhism that's developed them. They were central to the Buddha's teaching. And this sutta, it doesn't just talk about meditation, it's talking about metta in your life. It's talking about metta as an approach to life. So it's not an accident that the commentary is called Living with Kindness. That's what this sutta is getting at. The meditation practice is a sort of a sort of condensation of that in a very particular situation where you simplify all the externals of your life and you give some focused time to try and cultivate this quality of metta. But the point of the practice is that you bring metta more and more into everything, into your everyday life in every sphere. So the first sentence of this Metta Sutta, I'm just going to look at that very, very briefly. He who is skilled in his good, he who is skilled in his good, who wishes to attain that state of calm, nibbana, should act thus. He who is skilled in his good, who wishes to attain that state of calm, nibbana, should act thus. And then it goes on to say how that person should act. So the first kind of point that, well, Bhante brings out is this word skilled, in that Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on developing skills of working with our mind creatively in our life. And skillful or skilled is a good kind of term, because it implies that you can learn, like you learn a craft, you learn a skill. It takes time, you have to make an effort, but you can learn and you progress and you develop and you become more and more of an expert or certainly more capable in that skill. So the Buddhist path, you could say, is us learning in that sense. It's like a training. We're training our mind. And it says, he who is skilled in his good. So it's a skill in what's good for you. In what is really good for you. Yeah? You're learning what's really good for you and how to move towards what's really good for you. Your own happiness, you could say. You're learning about what's really fulfilling in life, and you're becoming more skilled in becoming more fulfilled, if you see what I mean. So he who is skilled in his good, who wishes to attain that state of calm, nibbana, should act thus. So the point that Bhante makes about this whole clause is that it's conditional. It's saying if you want to be skilled in your good, in what's good for you, if you wish to attain this state of nirvana, this state of calm, then you should act like this. And then it's going to teach you. It's going to say that you should act like this. The point is it's conditional in that you have to want to do it. It's not an injunction. It's not an imperative. It's not saying, do this. It's saying, if you want to learn what's really good for you, and you want to move towards this state of calm, then this is how you do it. And that conditional clause conveys something of the attitude of Buddhism. Yeah? In that Buddhism isn't didactic in the sense that it's telling you how to live your life. Nobody in Buddhism can tell you how to live your life. That the whole notion of power, of coercion, is foreign and even inimical to Buddhism. It's a conditional statement. It's saying, if you want to move towards this, then here's how you do it. And this is the Buddha speaking. So let me just pause there and see if there are any questions or comments about that. That sort of makes sense, doesn't it? I think it's just important to know what the attitude of the Dharma is, because it's very easy for us to start, particularly if you get more involved, particularly if you start to, I don't know, if you ask for ordination, as some of you have and some of you might, although of course you don't have to, if you do, it's easy to start to think that you have to behave in a certain way. And these big bad order members are some authorities that are telling you how to live your life, quite contrary to sometimes to what you want to do with your life. And that's just not how it is. On this side of the fence, as it were, as an order member, I think I can speak probably for most order members, if not all order members, if we're involved in teaching the Dharma at all, or befriending people who want to move towards ordination, it's in the spirit of it that they want to do it. And if they want to do it, this is how to do it. Not that you have to do it. Of course, you know, you can, order members can lose sight of that, I can lose sight of that, and the people who have asked for ordination can lose sight of that. But that is the spirit. Yeah. So how should we act? How should we act? So the whole this sutta, by the way, is in it's in verse. I mean, that doesn't come across necessarily in the English translation, but it would have been like a poem to Metta. It would have been almost sung. Well, it might have been sung. So the first couple of verses, let me read them to you. They're not particularly talking, well, they're not talking about meditation. They're talking about preparation for the cultivation of metta. So, he should act thus. He should be able, upright, perfectly upright, of noble speech, gentle and humble, contented, easily supported, with few desires, of light livelihood, with senses calmed, discreet, not impudent, not greedily attached to families. He should not pursue the slightest thing for which otherwise men might censure him. And only then does it say, may all beings be happy whatsoever, happy and secure. So you could say that all of this preparation, well, all of this is preparation, these are qualities that are indicating the sort of behaviour that we need to be engaging in, the sort of attitude that we need to be cultivating, the sort of skills that we need to be cultivating if we're going to cultivate metta successfully. This is the ethical foundation of the practice of meditation. There are lots of formulations of ethics. We've got the five precepts. This isn't using that sort of coded formulation. Instead, it's listing some qualities. It's listing some qualities. But what it's doing is the same thing. It's saying we need to be looking at the ethics in our life if we're going to cultivate metta. That's the first thing. It's our ethical actions. It's our ethical behaviour. And in a way, that's the main thing I want to emphasise this evening. Very, very often, even here at the centre, if somebody's struggling with meditation, we try and help them by looking at what's happening in meditation. We try and offer you, well, I've been offering you this evening, tips and techniques for working in the metta bhavana practice. That is important, but actually what's even more important is how we're living our life. If we were living our life according to the qualities listed in this sutta, if we were acting in a way that was always skillful, then when we came to sit down on our meditation chairs or cushions, metta would be the natural response. It would just emerge. Well, it has done for some of you tonight. It just emerges. It is already a natural kind of response. So ethics is a way of working on our meditation practice. In fact, it's the foundation of our meditation practice. But the first quality that's listed, I'm going to run through several of them. We may not get time to run through them all. But the first quality that's listed is perhaps not even concerned with ethics particularly. The Buddha seems to be starting not even with ethics. The first quality is he should be able. So able is a very, very broad kind of word, quite a basic word. What does it imply to you? I'll tell you in a minute what Sangharakshita has to say, but what does the word able imply to you as a quality? Yeah? Say a bit more?
So, that suggests to me that it's about your capacity for all of these qualities, and your. And that might be realised or not.
Or not.
Yeah. So, and I think it suggests that everybody has that.
Yeah.
However.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one sort of connotation of the word able, isn't it? That you've got potential. You've got potential. That's right. Yeah. And Buddhism would say, yes, everybody has that potential. It's innate in consciousness. So if you've got human consciousness, you've got that potential.
Can I just ask you one question?
Yeah, go on.
What about if somebody has got severe learning disabilities or mental health problems?
So, yes, if they have got mental health problems that are physiological, then they may not be able to, in this life, cultivate some of these skills and qualities. Buddhism would then take the perspective of lifetimes, and just because in this life the body doesn't support, or your physiology doesn't support the development of consciousness, that doesn't mean that this is the only life, if you see what I mean. Yeah. But yes, that does happen. So I think it's sort of, in a way, that's coming round to another word, another connotation of the word able, isn't it?
Yeah.
What can we say about this connotation of the word able? It's more like capable.
It's capable, yeah.
Capable, yeah. Yeah. So that's, I think, what partly has been got at. Yeah, you have.
I was wondering if we're talking about sort of the very sort of the basics of our consciousness, of our sort of being, is it something along the lines of able to choose?
Right.
You know, rather than if it's something we're actually remarking on,
yeah, yeah,
then it's a bit more than just the basic physiological functioning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is it, yeah, as I say, able to make choices?
Make choices, yeah, yeah.
As a way forward,
yeah,
to, you know, the other qualities.
Yeah, yeah. I think that does point to something. I think it's not something that Bhante particularly goes into, but I'll talk a little bit about that aspect of it. I think it implies that you're enough of an individual, you're integrated enough to make a choice, a conscious choice, for what you want to do in your life. Sometimes we're not integrated enough to make conscious choices. I guess you see it in children, for example. Or young people, they're not living particularly consciously. They're responding to whatever stimulus happens to be in their path at the moment. And they're not sort of standing back and saying, I want to do this with my life necessarily, or I even want to do this today. Mm-hmm. They're just saying, you know, pleasure, pain, responding accordingly.
Maybe not even realising they have a choice.
Not really realising that they have a choice. So for us to cultivate, to be capable in this way, to be able in this way, it implies a degree of awareness where we can take responsibility for our lives, take responsibility for our choices, make those choices, and then get behind those choices. So we're not just blown about by whatever stimulus happens to come our way. So that implies a degree of integration, which in a way is the first stage of the path. It comes with mindfulness, it comes with knowing ourselves, it comes with awareness of the different conditioning that makes us up. We get to know ourselves, and then we're able to more easily take responsibility for ourselves.
Yeah.
And take sort of conscious action.
It's interesting how you sort of identify that making the choice, but also then staying with it.
Staying with it, yes.
Not being blown and changing your mind.
Yeah, yeah. That's very easy to do, isn't it? Even for, well, we're all sort of grown-ups. It's very easy to make a choice one day and then forget about it the next day and do something quite contrary to the choice that we made. Never mind the day. It's easy to do that moment to moment, isn't it? Almost literally. Moment to moment, to sort of forget what we've set out to do.
Be distracted.
Yeah, we get distracted. So I think that's another connotation of this word able, that we're able to make choices. Bhante talks about it in a slightly different way. He just talks about being capable in a very, very ordinary human way. Like you're a capable human being in that you can make a meal, you can turn up on time to an appointment, you can, book some transport, arrange a meeting. You can basically live your life in a healthy-ish kind of way. It's that sort of capacity, that capability, that ordinary level of human integration, you could say, that he's saying is necessary. He's not saying, Bhante makes the point that the Buddha isn't saying you have to be some sort of pious spiritual aspirant. It's not about somebody who's very, very holy or pious. It's just about somebody who's capable of functioning as a healthy human being. Yeah? And knows what's good for them. So he gives the example of some early Sangha members, some early disciples of the Buddha, who he says weren't really likely candidates for the spiritual life. They were a bunch of young men who he calls playboys, out on a picnic with their wives, and one of them doesn't have a wife, and he's brought a courtesan with him on this picnic, and they're just having a good time. That's all they're doing, they're having a good time. But this courtesan turns out to be a bit wily, and she disappears with some ornaments, possibly some jewellery or whatever it is. She disappears on this picnic, and suddenly their enjoyment turns a bit sour, and they start looking for this woman, this disappeared woman, in the, I don't know, in the woods or whatever it is. And, so they were just having a good time, and now it's gone a bit sour, and they come across the Buddha in the forest, and he says, what are you doing? And they explain what they're doing. They're having a picnic, they're out on a picnic, and this woman's run off, this courtesan has run off with some ornaments, some of their belongings or whatever. And the Buddha just says, why are you wasting time searching for this woman? You'd be better off searching for yourself. For yourselves. You'd be better off searching for yourselves. And, of course, they must have got into some sort of dialogue with what did the Buddha mean? Search for myself. Search for myself. And, as often happens in these stories, when you encounter the Buddha, you're encountering a very, very, very powerful force. You're not just encountering an ordinary human being, you're encountering a consciousness that's gone beyond ordinary human consciousness. And in that dialogue, they become disciples. What Bhante points out is that they're not aspiring monks, they're not necessarily pious candidates, they're just ordinary, healthy human beings trying to enjoy life. It hasn't quite worked out, at least on this day. And the Buddha's sort of just met them and said, what are you doing, not just today, what are you doing with your life? Do you see what I mean? And with a bit of intelligent dialoguing, they can see that he's got a point. That's what. So capable in that way, just being a human being who can sort of do things, act, and is intelligent enough to want to be happy and tries to go about wanting to be happy. That's all you need. That's quite interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So let me just pause there and see if there are any comments. I mean, what Bhante does say is he says, a person who's truly capable can turn their capability in almost any direction. You can go out to work or choose not to. You might know how to do a bit of gardening, you might know how to do a bit of carpentry, you might be able to look after a baby or cook a meal from any leftovers in the kitchen. In fact, confronted with any given situation, difficult or otherwise, you can cope, you can manage, you can get by. I mean, that left me a bit thinking, oh dear. I'm not sure I could do half of those things. Look after a baby, cook with leftovers, carpentry. I'm not sure I could do any of those. So I'm taking it very lightly as a sort of example of generally being integrated enough to turn your hand to things, to manage to get by. I mean, what he does go on to say is that this capacity to be able, to be capable, it isn't just your doing. You might have had a very, very difficult upbringing. You might not have had the sort of nurturing that has provided you with the sort of psychological balance to be capable in this way. Do you sort of mean? Not everybody does. That's not necessarily your fault. So what he says is, if that's the case, well, just start from where you are. Just start from where you are. You'll probably need supportive conditions, you'll need friendship. You may even need therapy and some professional kind of help. But you just start from where you are, and you start to become more together, more integrated, more able as a human being, just as an ordinary human being. The other thing he says is that, well, the path is presented in a very systematic way. So you become capable, you become more ethical, then you start to cultivate metta. But actually, we kind of don't always do it in that systematic way. We teach people the metta bhavana practice when they walk through the door. And that's valid. There is a path called the path of irregular steps, where you don't start from the first step, you start somewhere in the middle, and then you have to go back and catch up in a way. So there is the path of irregular steps, and it sort of works because if you practice the metta bhavana, you do start to become a bit more able and capable and healthy psychologically. So you can... There's a reciprocal relationship between meditation and ethics, or meditation and this sort of capacity integration. Yeah.
I suppose the fact that it can work in a regular way like that,
yeah,
backs up the idea that things arise depending on conditions.
Yeah.
Because, you know, conditions are not always successive upon one another, but are actually more like like a fan that comes together.
Yeah.
And is integrated in that way. So
yeah.
Why not the metta?
Exactly. Why not the metta? And why not meditation practice? Exactly. I think Buddhism. Buddhists have tended, perhaps particularly early Indian Buddhists, have tended to really, really like systematizing things. And what they've done is create all sorts of lists and formulae for how the spiritual life can be lived. But actually, life isn't systematic in that way, for most of us anyway, most of the time. So you're right that actually conditionality teaches that you've got a whole network of conditions in play all the time. And some of those conditions are beyond your control, but some of them are within your influence. And if we just start working on the ones that we can influence, that gradually makes our minds emerge in a more positive way. I mean, one of the basics of ethics is that we're working with the law of karma. That's the level of conditionality that we're working with. We're working with the law of karma. Or as it's known, karma niyama. Niyama meaning law. So we're working with the law of karma. What does the law of karma say? What does the law of karma
do? Read Nagarpriya's book.
Oh, did you?
Yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm doing a course on Buddhism at the university. So
yeah.
I read it in one day.
Yeah.
But I suppose that, what I got from it was that that it is like a physical law, but only a law adapted to the moral realm.
Yeah.
So, whilst in the physical realm you might be able to predict with quite a lot of accuracy what will be the result of doing a physical action, like dropping a stone, you know that it will fall to the ground. With our moral actions, although there is some kind of law operating, it's not so easy to predict when the outcomes will present themselves.
Yes, it's more complex, perhaps, because there are more conditioning factors involved. But nevertheless, you're right. And I think you're right in saying that it's analogous or like a physical law. The point being that it's a natural law, just like the law of gravity or the laws of thermodynamics are natural physical laws. The law of karma is a natural law. It's the way the universe seems to work. It's natural in the sense that it's part of the fabric of things, it's part of how reality is, but it doesn't require an external creator to have created that law, just like you don't need to think in terms of a creator God to understand the law of gravity as a natural phenomenon. So it's of that order. But yeah, you're right, it's operating not at the physical level, but at the level of moral, it's at the moral level when we've got self-consciousness. So it emerges, this law becomes relevant, it comes into play when there are beings with self-consciousness. And by self-consciousness, I mean a being that can say I and have a sense of me as a distinct agent in the universe, in a way that probably an ant doesn't have a sense of me as a separate agent in the universe. Do you see what I mean? Human beings do have that to some degree or other. And it's when we have a sense of me as a separate agent that this moral law comes into play. Just as the law of gravity comes into play when there's matter. In the absence of matter, you wouldn't notice the law of gravity. So in the absence of self-consciousness, the law of karma wouldn't come into play. But it does when there is self-consciousness, or at least this sense of me as a separate agent. Ethan, yeah.
Can I request some clarification on that?
Yeah.
What I think I've heard, but I'm not sure was what you were actually saying, was that karma only comes into play where there's self-consciousness. But if all actions have consequences, surely the consequences would come into play whether there's self-consciousness or not?
Yeah, I mean, actions will have consequences at different levels, but if it's not a self-conscious action, then it won't necessarily come into play at a karmic level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, for example, you might do something accidental. You might knock over a vase and break it. If you've done it accidentally, without any sense of will or self-conscious intention, any choice, then the law of karma doesn't come into play.
Because it's not volitional.
I mean, there is the thing that you could say, okay, well, I was unmindful, and that's a sort of volition, that's starting to get into the volitional thing, so there might be a karmic element. But on the whole, karma is about volitional actions. Yeah, Lena. About the mindfulness thing.
Yeah.
But particularly if you're starting to practice, then if you're starting to practice, you're trying to develop mindfulness amongst other qualities, and then unmindfulness becomes more of an issue. Yeah? Because we're trying to learn to become mindful, so if I am unmindful, I can take more responsibility for my unmindfulness, if you see what I mean. Yeah.
Can you act in a very unconscious manner?
Yeah.
Does that not still have karmic effect? Like if you're so angry you kill someone or whatever, or that you're not thinking,
it depends on the
where the immersion of being self-conscious comes in.
Yeah, yeah. If you're angry and you act from anger, there's still will involved. So it might not be that you're very self-aware, but there is a consciousness behind that. There's a will involved, and that is a karmic action. It's where there's no will involved that it's not necessarily karmic. Yeah. So anger is a will. It's an expression of will. It's an expression of me, a sense of me making some sort of choice. What you're perhaps implying quite rightly is that the more self-awareness that we have, the more choice we have. If I've developed a lot of mindfulness, I might notice the anger arising but choose not to act from it. If I haven't developed a lot of mindfulness, I may not even notice the anger arising. The anger will arise and I'll just react. But nevertheless, that's karmic. Yeah? Because there's a will. Where there's a will, it's karma. So karma is willed action. Willed action. So the first thing, in a way, that we're learning is to... Before we can really start to work with this law of karma, we've got to become more and more self-aware and self-conscious in the way that we've just been talking about. More aware of who we are, more responsible for how we act. So this is the stage of integration, where we become more and more a single moral agent. So if you take a very young child, you couldn't expect them to be that aware of themselves as a moral agent. They're going to be acting from stimulus and response. We, as adults and as practitioners, are trying to become more and more like a single moral agent. So somebody who is capable of following through their intentions, who is able to take responsibility for their actions and the consequences of their actions. Yeah? That's integration. Once we've got a degree of that moral agency, once we've become integrated at least enough to know what we're doing, then the whole task is to learn to act more and more skillfully, more and more wisely, in accordance with the law of karma. And what the law of karma says is that the more skillfully we act, the more we will change our whole consciousness. It's as if consciousness re-emerges every moment. And consciousness, if we act skillfully, consciousness will re-emerge in a way that is more creative, more expansive, more bright, more fulfilled, more connected with others and the world around us, more flexible so that we can adapt to situations, more mindful, more aware, and often just more happy. So on the basis of becoming more and more integrated, we can learn to act more and more skillfully and use this law of karma. Because of course the converse is true. The law of karma also says that when we act more and more, when we act from unskillfulness, all the opposite happens. Our mind contracts, our consciousness contracts, it becomes less flexible, less creative, less bright, less fulfilled, more disconnected, more fragmented, more closed, probably more unhappy, more pained, and also will affect others in a similar way when we act unskillfully. So we affect ourselves, but we affect the world around us. So metta is skillful karma. It's a skillful action. It's a volition. It's an intention. And therefore it's skillful karma. It's highly skillful karma. And one of the things it does is it changes our own consciousness. It changes us. It changes our how we re-emerge as beings. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to engage our sense of moral agency to act more and more skillfully, so that we can change our whole mind in accordance with the law of karma. And metta is a very skillful action. So then, the whole, if you see it in those terms, the whole foundation of ethics makes more sense, because metta is just ethics. It's working on the law of karma. And if we're not doing that in our everyday life, then it's not very surprising if we find it difficult in meditation. Of course, it could be that we are doing it in our everyday life, but we're finding meditation difficult because we've got stuck in bad habits in meditation, or whatever it is. But the ethical foundation is essential. So the next word, for example, after able, is upright. Upright. So what does upright connote to you? He should be able, and then it says upright. Might mean physically upright, like awake, and but I think it means more than that.
Direct.
Direct, yeah. So what do you mean by direct? I think you're on the right track.
Sort of, being transparent.
Yeah.
What you do.
Yeah. Direct, transparent, straightforward.
Straightforward.
You know, you're sort of making that gesture, and that's what it is. It's straightforwardness. It's sort of clear, straightforward. You're not trying to fudge issues. You're not trying to pretend to be somebody that you're not. You've got straightforward communication and relationships with other people. You sort of tell it as it is, in a transparent way, in a clear way.
Integrity.
Integrity. Yeah, integrity. It's this straightness. Yes, Jenny.
It's also human. I mean, it's not on all fours as an animal.
Yes, it's upright in that sense as well, isn't it? So that's interesting, isn't it? Able and then upright. Yeah. Yeah, it's human. Yeah, it's human. Yeah. Interesting.
Or truly human.
Truly human, yeah. Yeah.
I think to me it also implies awareness.
Yeah.
So the uprightness goes with a greater sense of being in your environment.
Yeah.
Rather than the opposite, which would be, you know, asleep or...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not so present.
Yeah, that's right. It implies awakeness, doesn't it? And awareness in that sense, that's right. So all these qualities, I think, are important. Sort of human, just being human, being awake and aware. But then also being direct, being straightforward, being transparent, being not manipulating, not fudging, not being dishonest, either with yourself or with others, being clear. All of that is the foundation of ethics, in a way. Unless we can sort of be like that, then how are we going to learn to be more skillful? So I think this is very sort of fundamental. And Bhante says that it's almost as if you're going to be upright, you've got to be perfectly upright. The sutta says not just upright, it says be able, upright, and then it repeats it and says perfectly upright. The word is uju in Pali. It's uju, and apparently it was used in relation to arrows, you know, as in bow and arrow. And the arrow needs to be straight in order to fly. So it's straight in that sense, and then you can fly. You see what I mean? So it's straightforward. So that, in a way, is a sort of just an ordinary human virtue, isn't it? An ordinary human quality. But particularly, I think, in our complicated 21st century urban lifestyle, it isn't always that common, is it? How often do we just straightforwardly be transparent with other people? How often are we able to just say, this is how I am, and be honest with ourselves and each other? It's not always very common.
That seems to be a contradiction to the first requirement, being able, which seems to be quite a low bar. Even if you're a playboy,
It's gone up, hasn't it? The bar's gone up. It might be that we live in a complicated world, much more complicated than the world that the Buddha lived in. In the suttas, time and time again, you get people who approach the Buddha, and one of the things that they're not always, they don't even always agree with the Buddha, but one of the things you seem to get with the characters that appear in the sutta is that they say it like it is. They say, even disciples of the Buddha, like Magyar, goes off to the mango grove to meditate, a sort of when the Buddha had advised him not to go off just then. Magyar comes back and says, do you know what happened? The Buddha said, no, tell me what happened. He said, I was filled with lustful thoughts and thoughts of ill will, and it wasn't that interesting. And just completely transparent. And maybe that was more the case in the society of the Buddha at the time. Maybe it's just we've got more complicated and complex.
It's an English thing as well.
It's an English thing, yes, it is. It probably is. I didn't want to say that, but I'm glad you did. It might be an English thing, it might be a cultural thing. But I'm gonna stop in a minute because we've run out of time. What Bhante goes on to say, well, the next thing is of noble speech and gentle and humble. So this uprightness, this directness, he says, isn't an excuse for being unpleasant or rude insensitive and unfeeling to others. So it's not an excuse to just go around saying, I tell it like it is, and then just be unpleasant. It's actually followed on by, Bhante talks about being amenable and being flexible. So you try and accommodate yourself to the wishes of others if it doesn't really matter. You're easygoing, you're flexible, you're amenable to others. Yeah, you're of noble speech. And this quality of humility, it's not a sort of, it's not a Uriah Heep, ever so humble kind of humility. It's just the lack of conceit. It's the lack of thinking that I'm the centre of the universe, I'm the special one, I should get all my needs met, that everybody is somehow there to serve me and my needs. It's that lack of conceit. We're not special in that sense. Nobody is. And then, of course, it goes on to say contented. Speaks for itself. We could talk more about what contented means. Easily supported. You know, the monks used to rely on lay folk to support them. So if this was talking to monks, then the idea is that you shouldn't have too many needs. Just somebody else is providing for you. Of light livelihood, for example. It's saying, on the one hand, Bhante talks about how your work might be really important and you don't shirk it, you fulfil it. On the other hand, you don't work in a way that is avoiding getting to grips with deeper issues of your mind and your life, the existential issues of your life. It's possible to lose yourself in the busyness of work and lose perspective of actually what's going on. It can even be an avoidance tactic for not really looking at your mind and your life and the existential issues of life.
That's just so incredibly relevant. to modern life.
It is, yeah, it's completely relevant, isn't it? Completely relevant, yeah. Well, partly it's relevant because the Buddha's teaching, I think, is perennial, and it applies in all times and all cultures. As where there's human consciousness, it applies. And partly, Bhante has, he's a genius at making the Buddha's words relevant. He's a genius at sort of seeing the essence of them, taking them not necessarily literally at face value in the context that they were, because it was a very different cultural context, and the Buddha was talking to monks here. But Bhante's a genius at turning it into words that are relevant to us and still get to the heart of what the Buddha was talking about. So I very, very much recommend this book. We're going to carry on exploring it next week. I'm going to carry on exploring it. I'm going to next week look at... well, the idea is I look at metta and wisdom, at metta and insight, how metta leads to insight, how it is an aspect of insight. But I may say a little bit more about ethics, because there's much more to explore than we've had time for today. Okay, so hope to see you next week. Thank you.